Police Tactics on Trial. Today, Tuesday, August 13th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg vows to fight for stop and frisk. A police officer in the UK sees similar tactics there, and he urges fellow cops to stop and think carefully before they act.
To a police officer, it's something you might do every day, stopping a car or stopping a person in the street. To the person who stopped, it's a lifetime event.
Also today, a Pittsburgh janitor who's from Mexico says he wants a better life for his daughters.
I would like to see my daughter not working in a hotel or in a restaurant. I want to get something better for her.
Plus, maybe you should think twice before you get those bees for your backyard.
Urban areas have their own problems in that, and that you are very close to your neighbor.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, helping create healthy communities by supporting the work of United Way. United Way helps build pathways out of poverty by mobilizing the caring power of communities around the world, focusing on education, health, and basic needs. Learn how to help at unitedway.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg warns that his city could return to the bad old days of high crime without stop and frisk. That's the policing policy that a federal judge struck down yesterday. The judge ruled that New York police have systematically violated the civil rights of tens of thousands of people by wrongly targeting Black and Hispanic men. Britain has its own version of stop and frisk. It's called stop and search, and it's controversial there as well. Nick Glynn is 46 and Black, and he says he's been stopped and searched about 30 times in his life. But Glynn also has an unusual perspective. He's a cop, an inspector in the Leicestershire Police Force. So, Nick, tell us, please, about your most recent experiences being stopped.
In the city where I live, I was going into a club, and I showed my – I only had my police ID card on me. I didn't have any other form of photo ID. And I got grabbed by two police officers and in front of everybody because they didn't believe that my ID card was a real police ID card. And I think really they didn't really believe I was a police officer.
Yeah, I'm sure that's happened before. But I mean, what happens typically when you show your badge, your ID, or say you're a serving police officer?
Well, I get a variety of reactions. Sometimes, you know, it's fine. Other times, like this one, it hasn't made any difference, to be honest, and it ends up being a really unpleasant experience, actually.
Why do you think you get stopped like this 30 times now in the first place?
Well, certainly the most recent occasions, the last two or three occasions when I've been picked out, as I would call it, I'm sure that's because of my colour. A previous time I was stopped, again, in this same city, driving, and for the first time ever, I actually made a formal complaint about that because it was so obvious that was the only reason I'd been stopped. And the officer said it was basically because there was something wrong with my tire, which I genuinely thought he just made that up as just an excuse.
I mean, you're basically saying you get stopped because you don't look like other cops. So how do you not get furious when these events happen?
Well, ironically, because I'm a cop. and so I know how conflict works. You know, every stop and search, stop and frisk interaction is a conflict, and it's a potential conflict that could go wrong, and I know that. So I always ensure that whilst I might be able to express my frustration or whatever, I don't do that by getting angry or by losing my temper or swearing or doing anything that might get me in trouble, if you see what I mean. So that actually does help me.
And is the racial targeting criticism that Stop and Frisk in New York City has faced, is that also a big issue with Stop and Search in the UK?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's one of the main reasons why we have the system of recording and monitoring stop and search that we have. You can reduce the number of stop searches and yet still improve safety. You can improve crime reduction.
How do you do that? Because, I mean, while minorities, immigrants have understandably been annoyed by stop and frisk in New York, others have said it's made their communities safer. I mean, how do you get the balance right?
By targeting the use of that tactic in the right places on the right people, firstly. But secondly, you use other tactics that aren't so invasive and that are actually far more productive. Make sure that it's based on recent reliable intelligence, but also training for police officers, not only about the knowledge of their powers, but also for them to understand the impact of stopping somebody every time they do it. To the person who stopped, it's a lifetime event. And police officers, I think, have lost sight of that in general terms. So certainly some training that we put together in the place where I work in Leicestershire has highlighted that to ensure that they think about it before they use the power. And what that does is it makes them sometimes not use the power because it's the right thing to do not to use the power.
Nick Glynn, a police inspector in Leicestershire. He's also been stopped and searched many times. He joined us from his home in Nottingham. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
The state of Georgia has one of the strongest stop and show me your papers laws in the U.S. These kinds of laws are a product of the recent influx of Latino immigrants to the South. The changing demographic has sparked racial tensions as well as anti-immigration legislation. But Dalton in northwest Georgia has a different story. It's part of El Nuevo South. As part of our Global Nation coverage, Sam Harnett reports on how Dalton has embraced the new Latino culture.
If you're near the small city of Dalton in Georgia's Appalachian foothills, then you might hear this on the radio. Play-by-play of local high school soccer in Spanish.
Goal de la Dalton High School!
Dalton High recently won the 4A state championship and got ranked America's number one spring soccer team. The team's entirely Latino, except one player and the coach, Matt Cheeves. His Spanish is limited.
I can say animal names really well because my last name is Cheeves, and in Spanish sometimes they say Chivas, and so they call me Goat. But other than that, really, I don't say much in Spanish.
This year, the Goat didn't need to say much to his team in any language. They crushed their opponents. Cheeves recalls a game with an almost all-white team down near Atlanta.
They were kind of in shock and awe. About 15 minutes into the game, they'd given up more goals in that game than they had all season.
Cheeves says it felt strange to coach an all-Latino team when he started 19 years ago. Now, he doesn't even think about it.
It's a great thing to see. I really love that about Dalton.
But soccer isn't Dalton's traditional claim to fame. It's known more for something else. Carpets. There are over 150 carpet mills here. And the workforce used to be mostly white.
We're at the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains here in northwest Georgia, so there's a strong Appalachian culture here, very independent, very competitive.
Brian Anderson heads Dalton's Chamber of Commerce. He says in the late 70s, immigrants started coming to fill labor shortages in the carpet industry. Now, Dalton is 48% Latino. The rest of Georgia is just 9. While some parts of the state are resisting the changes brought by new immigrants, Anderson says that in Dalton, the two cultures have coexisted for over 30 years.
If you ask the average 9 or 10 people on the street, you know, what do you think about it? They'd almost be surprised by the question because it's been so prevalent for a while that we just don't think about it.
Jose Hajar says he feels integrated here. He came to Dalton from Mexico with his family more than 30 years ago.
In 1994, I became a U.S. citizen. You know, I went through the process. So I no longer carry what they call a green card.
Though he may want to carry some proof of citizenship if he travels to other places in Georgia or the South. 2 years ago, Georgia joined a handful of other states, including Alabama, to pass a, quote, show me your papers law. It lets local police detain and jail people determined to be here illegally, a power usually reserved for federal officials. The law has caused some unrest in Dalton, but not a mass exodus. The Latino roots here are too deep. You can see that at any of the city's growing number of recreational soccer fields.
Alex, Alex, Alex.
The students from Dalton High's soccer team learn the sport on these rec fields by playing with adults like Rafael Mendiola. He was on the school's team in 2003, back when they won their first state championship.
They want to gain experience from us. That's what they say. They're like, hey, we want to play with them because we're going to get experience. So why not? We let them play.
Caleb Peniagua on Dalton High's soccer team this year is inspired to be around guys like Mendiola.
It just feels good to play right there beside him. And then, you know, and then me, that I won it. It's just, it's a dream, you know, accomplishment.
Next to Peniagua is his friend Eder Mora, also on Dalton High's team. Like many of the young players here, his parents work in the carpet mills. He says they want him to focus on bigger dreams, like college.
It's not very easy. That's why they say it takes education seriously so I can be even better than they are and give my family a better atmosphere to live in.
soccer could lead to that education. Nearby Dalton State College is awaiting approval to start a soccer program and offer scholarships. Paniagua says he'd definitely try out. For The World, I'm Sam Harnett, Dalton, Georgia.
That's the story of one town's transformation, but there's mounting pressure on Washington to make changes at the national level. Some of that's coming from immigrants who've gone to Capitol Hill to lobby for immigration reform. They've been telling stories about life in the shadows, what it's like to live here undocumented. The World's Jason Margolis recently met one of these new lobbyists in Pittsburgh.
Hector, who asked me not to use his full name, is originally from Mexico City. 15 years ago, after a brief stop in Colorado, he arrived at Pittsburgh's downtown Greyhound station.
March 14, was still snow, and was my first time seeing snow. Just tried to survive, you know. I mean, there was a really nice guy in the Greyhound. He saw me for the third day in the Greyhound, and I was sleeping in the benches. He make a little room and his room for where they put the mud bucket and stuff.
He spent 3 months sleeping in the janitor's closet.
I hope he no get in trouble for that.
There weren't many Spanish speakers in Pittsburgh at the time, and Hector spoke no English. Eventually, a guy who ran a Chinese restaurant noticed him at the bus station.
He told me, "Hey, amigo trabajo," and I said yes, and that's where I get my first job.
Since then, Hector has worked steadily.
I've been doing pretty much everything, washing dishes, farming. I used to take care of 58 horses by myself. But that was a really good job. I've been doing cooking for 10 years, and some of the restaurants, you start working 10 o'clock in the morning and you finish 11 for $5-6 an hour.
That's 11 in the evening. After 4 years in Pittsburgh, Hector says he got a green card, then brought his wife and two young daughters up from Mexico. But even though Hector says he now has a green card, he was visibly nervous speaking with me. Members of his family are here illegally, and he's worried about exposing them. He described what it's like for undocumented immigrants to live in the shadows.
And the shadow means it's hard for us to go to the police and say, "I just got robbed," you know. Or somebody jump you in the streets, take all your money, and we have to get quiet because we can't go to the police and ask him for help.
One of his daughters is now in high school, and the other just graduated. They're both so-called dreamers, immigrants brought to this country as children who are hoping to gain legal status here. He's hoping his girls can find better work than he has. Today he's a union janitor in a downtown high-rise.
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the job I do or some other Mexicans do, but if you don't have papers, if you don't have the right help, because we don't know much about the law, I would like to see my daughter not working in a hotel or in a restaurant. I mean, there's nothing wrong, you know, it's a job. But I want to get something better for her. That's why I moved her many, many miles away from home.
Many immigration reform advocates are hoping more voices like this will emerge and help sway members of the House to support a path to residency for undocumented immigrants. But personal stories won't persuade everybody. Many undocumented immigrants have worked hard and played by the rules once they got here, but they still broke the rules when they entered. And persuading some members of Congress to look past that remains the biggest challenge. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Pittsburgh.
Hector's first days here were tough. If you're an immigrant or your parents or grandparents were immigrants, tell us about your first days in the U.S. Share your stories on Twitter or Facebook with the hashtag #FirstDays, one word. This is The World on Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, helping create healthy communities by supporting the work of United Way. United Way helps build pathways out of poverty by mobilizing the caring power of communities around the world, focusing on education, health, and basic needs. Learn how to help at unitedway.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Urban apiculture is what this next story is about. That would be raising bees in the city. It's a good entry point if you're trying to be a farmer in the city. It can even earn you some green cred. And beekeeping is booming in Britain's urban areas. In the past 5 years, the number of hives in London has more than doubled. That's according to figures released by Britain's National Bee Unit. But the uptick in city apiculture has some scientists wondering if it might be doing the insects more harm than good. Karen Alton is with the Laboratory of Apiculture and Social Insects at the University of Sussex. And Karen, a bee is most certainly a social insect. You've just co-authored a study looking at the effects of urban beekeeping on bees, where the society of bees meets a society of humans. What did you find?
Yes, it's an interesting story, actually. We have had such an upsurge in the interest in beekeeping in the UK, concentrated around our urban areas. And this is fine, except it is putting a little bit pressure on some of our wild population of bees, possibly, and also other pollinators. And we have to sort of question, is this the right thing to do, to sort of concentrate our bees in such small areas?
I mean, I got to say, it's slightly counterintuitive. I mean, we're told on one hand that bees are good for the environment. In fact, urban beekeeping is often floated as one of those ways you can help. And yet it seems like starting new hives in urban areas, we may be hurting them.
I think you've got to make sure that there's enough forage for them. I think the problem is that you can underestimate how much land is actually needed to feed these bees. And, you know, urban areas are particularly dense in buildings and in roads. You know, there's a lot of dangers for bees then. If you've got a sort of concentrated amount of hives in one area, there is a chance that if there are any problems with diseases, they're going to be transmitted a lot quicker. And, you know, it's a responsibility being a beekeeper. And urban areas have their own problems in that, and that you are very close to your neighbor.
It sounds like what you're saying is that there is kind of a ratio, an environmental ratio of bees to humans that needs to be observed. Is there a saturation point for bee populations?
I don't think we've actually got the research to prove that yet. But, you know, if you're sort of looking at an analogy of saying trying to help African elephants, you wouldn't sort of just produce or bring in lots of elephants into an area where you weren't sure whether the habitat could sustain it, would you? And I think that's the same situation here. You know, a lot of our insect populations are declining. So I think it's important that we take those into consideration. You know, there's a lot of work still to be done looking at urban beekeeping, which is a fairly new sort of trend. But, you know, there are other ways of helping bees.
Right.
Know?
I mean, I was going to say, I mean, what's an urbanite who wants to do right by the environment and for bees to do? I mean, should you start a garden instead of a beehive?
I think that's an excellent idea. Absolutely excellent idea. And, you know, you can get your whole community, you can get your business involved. You know, if offices have a bit of green space outside, they can plant lots of nectar-rich forage out there. They could actually plant food, you know, some fruit bushes or a couple of trees or something like that, and, you know, apple trees or whatever, and actually enjoy both having the produce and having, you know, the pleasure of the bees there.
So you're involved in something called Flowerscapes, which I believe addresses some of these solutions. Tell us about Flowerscapes.
Well, Flowerscapes is a company that I co-founded with my partner. And basically, we create habitats across the UK, which enhances the areas for pollinators and other insects. So we do, we've got some areas here on campus. We work with local councils.
Planting bee-friendly plants, is that right?
Absolutely.
You know, I read recently about a plan undertaken by some urban guerrilla farmers in San Francisco to graft fruit branches onto the trunks of city sidewalk non-fruit trees, and it seems like a great way to produce more food in the city, but critics say things like that will be confusing and ultimately destructive for bees. Do you think we just need a better...
I'm not sure that's the case, actually, because... You know, bees will go where their forage is good and they look for high nectar concentrate. So if you've got flowers, you know, that produce a lot of nectar, the bees will be there. And whether that's a wildflower or an alien species, you know, garden flower, tropical garden flower, it doesn't really matter. The bees will go where the nectar is. So get producing, get plants in there, or trees or bushes, anything that the other insects can enjoy too. You know, we've got pollen beetles, we've got hoverflies, butterflies. I mean, a lot of these species are all in decline. So anything that we can do to help them, it's got to be beneficial, really.
Karen Alton is with the Laboratory of Apiculture and Social Insects at the University of Sussex. Our own April Peavy is attempting some backyard beekeeping. Check out her apy adventures at theworld.org. Instead of asking about a place in the world for today's GeoQuiz, we're looking for the name of a new Facebook game. Not some silly time suck. No, scientists and game developers in Britain came up with this new app. Its name comes from a scientific term. It's the Latin name of a fungus. Calara fraxinia was first discovered in Poland, where it wiped out the country's ash trees. It spread across Europe and Scandinavia. Most of Britain's ash trees now have the fungus, and Irish trees are getting it too. Scientists are urgently looking for solutions to save Europe's ash trees, and someone came up with the idea of using crowdsourcing to help analyze complex sets of ash tree genetic data. So what would you name a Facebook game designed to fight a fungus that's killing ash trees? Let's see, maybe Angry Fungus, Ash Tree Blitz, how about Fungus Wars? Nah. The real answer's coming up later in the show. Let's stay on the theme of nifty innovations for a minute. Think of life-changing technologies these days, and the image that comes to mind might be an iPhone, something incredibly complex and sophisticated that expands your whole idea of what's possible. Okay, now keep that in mind, but instead of an iPhone, picture this. A clear plastic soda bottle, some water, and a teaspoon or two of bleach. Put them together, and you get something that can be even more life-changing. For millions of people, a light inside their homes. It's an incredibly simple idea. Cut a hole in your roof, stick one of those bottles through it, secure it with some sealant, and you've got something roughly equivalent to a 60-watt light bulb. The idea isn't new, but in the last few years, it's taken off around the developing world.
Starting out in 2011... with one bottle and one beneficiary. Right now, we're 140,000 homes in the Philippines.
That's Ilac Diaz speaking with the BBC. He's a social entrepreneur from the Philippines. Diaz builds low-cost houses using materials like bamboo, old tires, and plastic bottles. Often the places he works have limited access to electricity, and a cheap light can make a huge difference in people's lives, even if it's only available during the day. Each bottle light works by refracting sunlight through the water and bringing it into the house. The bleach keeps the water clear by killing any algae. Alfredo Moser thought it up. He's a Brazilian mechanic who got the idea when a friend suggested he make a lens out of a bottle of water to start a fire during a blackout. The idea of capturing sunlight in a bottle stayed in his head.
The only places that had power were the industries, not people's houses. So people started to adopt this new idea of the Moser bottle lamp. It's a divine light. God gave the sun to everyone.
Moser never tried to make any money off his idea, and he never dreamed it would spread around the world. But Ilac Diaz says he's already helped bring the bottle light to roughly 360,000 homes in 15 countries. Talk about catching lightning in a bottle. If you want to see some of these Moser lights in action, check out the video we've posted at theworld.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, Edward Snowden started communicating with filmmaker Laura Poitras because he knew she was already under surveillance.
Having been under surveillance, she had had to kind of begin to live a semi-encrypted life. And so she was able to correspond in an encrypted way with anybody. And Snowden became aware of that.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, helping create healthy communities by supporting the work of United Way. United Way helps build pathways out of poverty by mobilizing the caring power of communities around the world, focusing on education, health, and basic needs. Learn how to help at unitedway.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. When Edward Snowden first reached out to journalist Glenn Greenwald, Greenwald ignored his emails, so Snowden turned to documentary filmmaker Laura Poitras. Some of their exchange reads like a spy thriller. For example, he warned Poitras about creating a password that would be nearly impossible to hack. Assume that your adversary is capable of a trillion guesses per second. Little did Poitras know that that encrypted email from him would lead to one of the biggest exposés of the U.S. government and may well define the rest of her life. Journalist Peter Moss recently met with Laura Poitras at the home in Brazil of journalist Glenn Greenwald. Moss profiles Poitras for the New York Times Magazine. So set the scene for us when you met Laura. Tell us about that first meeting in Brazil with her and Glenn Greenwald.
It was a very unusual location because Glenn Greenwald lives in Rio to begin with, which is unusual for an American journalist who's breaking such big news. And he lives in a kind of remote part of Rio, really on the edge of the jungle, in a house where there are monkeys swinging around, there are banana trees. He's got 10 dogs, one cat. And he sits on a porch in his house in flip-flops and surf shorts with his computer and just writes away. And I went there and Laura was there. She's at her computer. She had several computers, one for editing, one for communicating, and one that's air-gapped, which means that it's never been connected to the internet. So that's the one that she views her sensitive documents on. That's where they were working from, in this kind of crazy house in the jungle where the electricity went off occasionally. The water went off when I was there. You know, dishes are piled in the sink because nobody really has a lot of time to take care of those sorts of things. And this is where it was all happening.
So the portrait you paint, Peter, of Laura Poitras is that of a pretty intense individual. What was she like in person?
She is a very intense person. She is at the same time a very kind of fades into the background type of person. As a filmmaker, she really kind of tries to, you know, not be the center of attention, not like, you know, hey, this is my camera, I'm the filmmaker, do what I want, but really just blend in. Her toughness is kind of exhibited mostly in firm quiet rather than aggressive language or behavior.
Do you think that toughness, that Laura's toughness, is essentially what led her to this story? I mean, why did Snowden choose her?
One of the great ironies of this whole story is that it is because Laura Poitras was under surveillance from the United States government that Snowden chose her. And he chose her not because specifically she had been under surveillance, but because having been under surveillance, she had had to kind of begin to live a semi-encrypted life. And so she was able to correspond in an encrypted way with anybody. And Snowden became aware of that. And that's why he was able to begin this dialogue with her and bring in Glenn Greenwald shortly afterwards, who he had tried to reach out to, but who didn't have encryption software, didn't know how to communicate in an encrypted way.
As you describe it, Peter, there's a lot of cloak and dagger communication leading up to the meeting in Hong Kong. But when they arrive, it really starts to feel like fiction, from meeting the contact at the Hong Kong Mall, who turns out to be Snowden, who was carrying a Rubik's Cube to identify himself, to they're taking the batteries out of their phones and sticking the phones in the fridge for privacy. What precautions did you have to take in your conversations with Poitras?
You know, the way that these conversations went, there were just some topics that Laura and Glenn could not talk to me about. How they communicated and when the documents were exchanged, these sorts of things they wouldn't really talk to me about because they didn't want to provide information that the government might use to prosecute them and also to prosecute Edward Snowden.
No, you didn't meet Snowden, but you were able to access an interview with him through Laura Poitras, an encrypted Q&A. And the final question you asked Snowden was whether he was surprised that Poitras immediately started filming when they met in his hotel room in Hong Kong. And his answer kind of intrigued me. He says, as one might imagine, normally spies allergically avoid contact with reporters or media. So I was a virgin source. Everything was a surprise. And his use of the word spy, how did Snowden see himself?
You know, I can't really speak to that because the questions I asked him that he responded to were really about his work with Glenn and Laura. You know, the one thing that I would say, though, that really was among the many interesting things that he said in that interview was that one of the reasons he came to trust Laura as much as he did was because in their initial exchanges, she was more paranoid of him than he was of her. And he himself, as he said in this Q&A, is famously paranoid. You know, she was more careful, I think, in getting involved in this correspondence and exchange of documents and information with Snowden than even Snowden himself was.
Where does Laura see this story going and taking her along with it?
She's very open about what her beliefs are. You know, she doesn't kind of hide behind the, oh, I'm a journalist, I don't have any opinions kind of dogma. she's in yet another ironic position. You know, the first irony in a sense is that because she was under surveillance, Snowden sought her out and she had the skills to communicate with him. She defends her privacy as much as she can. She doesn't like to talk about, you know, her personal life at all, her background, anything of that sort. And the irony is that because she has become involved now with Snowden, she's not going to be able to have probably much of a private life for the rest of her life. They have thousands of classified and top secret NSA documents, and they've only published a very small number of them so far, actually.
Do they want to publish more?
They're planning to publish more. They're very clear about that. What that means, however, is that, you know, they're going to be holding on to these documents for the rest of their lives, I suppose. And so they're going to have to keep these secrets. As much as they're exposing, they're also keeping secrets. And they're going to have to keep them for a long time. And that's not necessarily a comfortable position to be in.
Do you think journalists can remain impartial about this story? I mean, you've essentially just told the facts in the Laura Poitras profile as you know them. But you know what's at stake with privacy and democracy. Have you managed to remain impartial?
No. But I think the question is based on this idea that journalists can be impartial on anything. I don't see how an individual who has a particular cultural, political, economic, social background can be impartial on anything. We are kind of formed by and victims of our upbringing, of what race we are, what class we are, what gender we are. So I don't think on any issue, really, there's impartiality. There's an attempt to be fair. There's an attempt to be rigorous. There's an attempt to be critical in your thinking. But impartial? Do I have opinions on this? Yes, I do. I think it's a real problem. I think that there's a problem in our democracy when our government is able to look at all of our correspondence and all of our movements. I think it has an effect even if we're not aware of it.
Journalist Peter Moss, you can read his profile of Laura Poitras in the New York Times. We'll have a link at theworld.org. Peter, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Marco.
Edward Snowden's in Russia, having gained temporary asylum there, and that Russian part of his saga has infuriated the U.S. government. But a lot of people are more angry about another Russian initiative, a new law that outlaws so-called gay propaganda. Some are even calling for a boycott of Russia's Winter Olympics in Sochi next year. No talk of boycott, though, at the track and field world championships going on right now in Russia. They're taking place in Moscow, President Vladimir Putin's home turf. Nicole Nazaro is covering the world championships for Runner's World this week. She's been spending her days at the stadium where we caught up with her. And Nicole, how much is the anti-gay propaganda law overshadowing the track and field championships?
You know, Marco, interestingly, it's not overshadowing the World Track and Field Championships at all. And I think one of the reasons is that we know we're here to cover an international sporting event, and we understand that the athletes who are here have been preparing, some of them, for 20 years or more. It's hard to expect them to have a viewpoint that they're willing to share publicly. At the same time, the journalists have given these athletes an opportunity to talk about it if they wanted to.
It's not unheard of, though, that politics gets drawn into sports. Why isn't this being discussed, do you think? I mean, isn't it an important story there?
It's not that it's not an important story in Russia, but at the World Track and Field Championships, remember, we're around the international sports community. And I think some of the athletes feel a little bit blindsided when they start feeling like they have to talk about it when they're in the middle of a world championship. The American 800-meter runner Nick Simmons is actually a great example of one way that athletes can be very involved in talking about what their beliefs are and being able to influence positively, and that he's been blogging for Runner's World and has some marvelous writing on his personal beliefs about gay and lesbian rights. But he also said, when I'm in the host country, I'll respect them, I will shake their hand, and then I will win the race and then help them to see that in a free society, people can live well. And I think the best thing that you can do in a situation like this when you're at the World Championships is to respect the athletes and respect their need to really focus on their competition.
And that runner who's blogging that you referred to, who's at the games there in Moscow, is he openly gay?
No, I don't believe so. I don't know that any one athlete has come out as being gay. But Nick Simmons most assuredly has been talking about gay and lesbian issues and, you know, human rights issues. He is very much a proponent of equality. But he chooses to talk about it when he's at home and to focus on the competition when he's at the competition.
It just seems so odd that, you know, a big issue like this gay propaganda law would not be discussed. It just seems odd in this day and age.
It's just, I think, understood that, you know, it's it's a part of the political scene around this country that we happen to be in right now. It's not a part of what's happening on the field of play. I'm going to go back to about 2008 when the U.S. women's gymnastics team, who are basically teenagers, were being asked about Chinese human rights issues. Mm. And I'm just wondering, does that seem fair to them? Think about it. If they started gymnastics when they were 3 or 4 years old and they suddenly get a chance to compete when they're 17 in the Olympics, and suddenly it's in a country that has issues with the United States, is it fair to them?
So the focus remains firmly on sports, even though there's lots of controversial stuff in the air. What do you think is the takeaway from all this?
I think one of the takeaways actually is that, and if I can give you just a little bit of background, I actually studied in the Soviet Union, and when it was the Soviet Union 22 years ago, This is my sixth trip to Russia. This country has changed so much in the last generation. They still have a ways to go, but I think that the takeaway is that when we come to a country and we act like guests and then win and present ourselves well and show that a free society where there are rights for all, I think that is a great way to educate other governments on what's possible in a free society. And I hope that other journalists from around the world also continue to push this story, because this is a story that we shouldn't just pay attention to during the time of a sporting event. We should always pay attention to these issues.
Nicole Nazaro covering the track and field world championships going on right now in Moscow for Runner's World. Thanks for your point of view, Nicole. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Okay, got a few extra minutes on your hands today. How about helping to solve one of Europe's most vexing environmental challenges through a new Facebook app, a game? It's called Fraxinus, and that's the answer to our GeoQuiz today, Fraxinus. The game's name comes from a fungus that's attacking ash trees throughout Europe. So some British scientists came up with this game to boost efforts to save the trees. Dan McLean is head of bioinformatics at Sainsbury Laboratory in the UK. First of all, the Latin name of this fungus, and how big a problem is it?
Okay, so the Latin name of the fungus is Calara fraxinia in full, and it's having a huge impact all across Europe, actually. It was first noticed in Poland in the early 1990s, and it made its way into England late last year, and since then, to Ireland. And the British ash population is under great strain at the moment. There are about 80 million ash trees in Britain, and we think that up to 72 million of them, that's 90%, could be under threat.
Wow, that's huge. So how do you hope a Facebook game might help you crack the problem?
Well, we're really looking at the long game here. With the Facebook game, what we've got is a way of anyone who wants to help to be able to contribute scientific results to our databases. The game lets people interact with the scientific data. That gives us a great catalogue of what we use as genetic variation. And we can take that, and ultimately, with this, we'll be able to carry out experiments to try and associate the genetics with things like resistant traits in the tree, and hopefully, ultimately, breed resistant tree stocks.
Okay, still kind of abstract for me. Tell me how you play the game. How do you make ash tree genetics fun?
Okay, cool. So when you load up the game, what you've got is something that looks visually a lot like an abacus, coloured shapes in rows. And the very top row is the target pattern. And what the player must do is try and arrange the lower rows to look as much like that top pattern as possible. And that's what humans are great at, that pattern matching skill. And that's why we don't use computers for these ones, because the humans are so much better.
So how many players do you have so far?
A few hundred. It's been going for a day, and we've had up to 100 people at a time all day playing it. So I reckon it goes into a few hundred, maybe a thousand.
And so are you essentially then asking the players to solve puzzles for you?
That's right, yeah. They're solving a self-contained puzzle. It's very evident what the puzzle is in its own terms. It's a fun game to play on its own. But we've plugged in some science into the background in our own databases, and we're able to take the results from those guys and make real use of them. The players are contributing something very, very valuable to us.
You don't actually have to be living in an area of England, for example, that has ash trees under threat and reporting that back. This solving the puzzle is doing that. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, if you're interested in helping out with the science, or if you're personally affected by your local wood being affected by ash, then those are all great reasons to help out and have a go. And you don't need any scientific background, because the game is a self-contained puzzle.
Well, I mean, you're essentially crowdsourcing part of your scientific process, right?
That's right. So I think we're the first people to put this sort of scientific crowdsourcing into Facebook and to try and take advantage of a social network. But there have, over the last couple of years, been examples of this sort of crowdsourcing in biology.
What's at stake with the ash tree? I mean, why is it so important as a species?
Well, it's very important ecologically. It supports a lot of biodiversity, so we stand to lose a lot of that if the ash tree goes. It's important historically and as well. It was a very important tree to the Vikings, and so it has a lot of history wrapped up in it, and it'd be a shame to lose some of our ash forests.
Key for baseball bats, too, just saying.
Yeah, it was used for spears by the Romans.
Well, Dan McLean, head of bioinformatics at Sainsbury Laboratory, thanks for telling us about Fraxinus, this Facebook game.
Thank you very much indeed.
And we'll link to the game at theworld.org so you can play and do your part for the ash trees. Another taste of one of my hot musical picks of the summer coming up on The World from Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. The Cuban capital, Havana, now has its very first English-language bookstore. Cuba Libro opened its doors to customers last week. Connor Gorey is a journalist and New York City native who came up with the idea for Cuba's first English-language bookstore. She's been living in and reporting from Cuba since 2002. So, Connor, you're American. You opened an English-language bookstore in Havana. Were you surprised this idea even took off?
The demand hasn't really surprised me because I've been living here since 2002 and reporting as a journalist, as you said. And I've seen that lots of people come here and they're looking for books to read on their vacation and they don't have access to books here. There are English books available, but they're mostly historical or political. And also Cubans are gobbling up English books, English classes. There's a big push to learn English here amongst the local populace. And so we're extraordinarily pleased with the enthusiasm and all the energy that has been generated by Cuba Libro and all the people that are coming in to have coffee and converse and buy books and magazines and just read and in a nice garden atmosphere.
Right. So you can get coffee there as well. So tell us about Cuba Libro. Where is it in Havana? Describe it.
It's on a very loud corner. I don't know if you can hear the trucks going by, but it's on the corner of Calle 24 and Calle 19 in the Vedado district. And any of your listeners that know Havana know that Vedado is the hot spot. It's where the nightlife is really happening. It's where a lot of the private restaurants are located and music clubs. And it's a leafy residential district. And we have a wonderful corner spot with hammocks and towering trees. We've got a palm tree. We've got a huge almond tree, which drops almond bombs every once in a while. And so it's a really great location.
You must have faced some challenges making this happen. I mean, as an American, you can't own a private business in Cuba. How are you working that out?
That's correct. I've been married to my Cuban husband since 2002, and it's his family that owns the place. The idea was mine, but we, you know, in the spirit of teaming up, you know, between U.S. and Cuban, because, you know, there's so much polarization around U.S. and Cuba, and my experience has been, you know, being married to a Cuban and having a Cuban family that, you know, we can build bridges, and we don't need to engage in these divisions and things. And Cuba Libro is a result of that. And once the 2011 economic opening really started to take hold, it began in 2010 with national debates here, and then economic reforms began to roll out, and they're still rolling out. It became possible for Cubans to own private small businesses like Cuba Libro. And so the idea was mine, and the business is theirs, and we teamed up and are bringing, you know, Yankee pluck and, you know, market savvy, quote-unquote. I'm not all that savvy. And Cuban ingenuity and humor and creativity together to create a different kind of space in Havana.
What about the restrictions on the U.S. side? Is it difficult to get books from here in the U.S. to your bookstore in Havana?
That is very complicated, and it's, you know, it always takes two to tango. And generally, you know, people are responding to our donation requests because all of the books are donated. All of the books are secondhand. From the United States, it's difficult because postage service between the United States and Cuba hasn't been normalized yet. It's been ongoing negotiations for decades about that. I have a post office box here in Havana, so that's one way that we're trying to see if people can send boxes of books here. And the other way is just people bringing them in their suitcases. The one thing is that we don't accept all books. We have a Connor filter. I'm the Connor filter. I believe that life is too short for bad books, and so I am the last word, and I will, you know, not sell a book if I don't think it's appropriate for Cuba Libro. But the donation angle of it, luckily there are a lot of expats here. There's the diplomatic community. There's the business community. So there are more foreigners living here than people might realize. And so we're going to slowly but surely start getting the word out that we're accepting donations. And already donations are coming in, which is very encouraging.
So it must be a pretty eclectic collection of books for sale at Cuba Libro. Give us a few of the titles.
A few of the titles. Okay, well, some of my favorites. We Catch 22 by Heller. That sold the first day. It got snapped up. I'm a big Barbara Kingsolver fan. La Lacuna, I think it's her latest book we have here. The Cubans are really interested in politics and philosophy and history. Another one, Joseph Stiglitz, Free Fall. This kind of nonfiction book is really popular here.
You know, it feels like you are a Cuba supporter. I don't think you'd deny that. Do you feel like you're able, being married to a Cuban, opening this bookstore in Havana, that you're kind of able on a freelance basis to negotiate the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba on your own terms?
Well, that's the thing. The important thing, Marco, is that it's on my own terms. One of the greatest pieces of feedback that I continually get on my writing is that here is someone who is writing with a balanced view. I'm not in agreement with many of the policies on the U.S. end, for sure, and there have been mistakes on the Cuban end, for sure, that no society is perfect. And so I think one of the tools that I have and one of the strengths that I have is that I'm able to keep above the politics of it all. Here we're talking about books. We're talking about literature. We're talking about having a healthy green space for people to share conversation, and it doesn't have to involve politics.
Connor Gorey, journalist and the brains behind Cuba's first English language bookstore, Cuba Libro. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Marco.
I know you may have expected us to end the show today with the hottest new song from Havana, or maybe a classic tuned deep in the Cuban music vaults. I mean, after all, Havana is one of the world's music-heavy capitals. But oh no, people, we're heading clear across the globe to another island nation that's not usually on the music radar, New Zealand. Yep, New Zealand. That's where the funk bass band Fat Freddy's Drop is from. Now, you may recall that last month I selected Fat Freddy's Drop's new album Blackbird as one of my summer music picks. You can hear that track and my love for the band at theworld.org, but I've been unable to stop listening to Blackbird. So let's close out today with another track from it. This one's called Bohannon. Remember the American disco bandleader and producer Hamilton Bohannon? Maybe, maybe not. Anyway, the Kiwis in Fat Freddy's Drop wrote it in his honor, and you can feel it. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. I tweet at Marco Werman. We tweet at PRI The World. That's our show today. Thanks for tuning in.
Co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems, online at ritaallen.org. and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund, furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet.
PRI, Public Radio International.